Welcome to What Comes Next Live. I'm your host, Tom McCallum. I'm really passionate about what I call open leadership and write daily on tommccallum.com. Now, open leaders have core qualities that drive them, four of which are to be brave, hungry, open, and humble. I'm always inspired by listening to the thoughts of leaders I meet, which led to the idea for this show, half an hour of conversation where our guest first shares a little about themselves and their thoughts on what comes next. Then together we'll look to draw out some insights that are actionable for our audience. Today's guest, I'm really pleased to say, is my friend Chip Conley, who I have lurked around for many years and learned so much from everything he's written and spoken for at least 15 years. And we met a couple of years ago, and I have learned that my learning has become greatly accelerated through that, including two visits as a cohort member of the Modern Elder Academy in El Pescadero, Mexico. And I've not spoken with Chip since all of this craziness started. So without further ado, I'll hand over Chip. Tell us a bit about yourself, where you are, what you're thinking.
Sure. Tom, it's an honor to be here with you. And I've been able to actually see you in London, which was last year, which I loved. And I'm in Mexico. I am at our MEA campus, Modern Elder Academy campus, in southern Baja. So for those who know a little bit about Mexico, it's about an hour north of Cabo San Lucas, which is at the far end, southern end of the Baja Peninsula, basically beneath where California, the U.S. state is. But it's a long peninsula. We're like, you know, about 1,000 miles from the border of the U.S. We've been closed here since March 15th. And we don't reopen until October. So it's been a fascinating time to sort of just be in touch with nature and have time to write. Just finished writing a white paper, which we can talk about. And sort of just imagining the future. I've spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, what does the future look like for me? It's my 60th birthday this Halloween, this October. So, you know, sometimes those seminal birthdays get you to thinking bigger thoughts.
Well, tell me about it. Tell me what big thoughts you're having about what's coming next. As you say, that is a big, I'm not there yet. I'm 6 years younger than you, so five and a half years younger than you. So, but I remember my 50th birthday year being a big year. So.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, ever since I was 30, I celebrated this birthday, a zero or five birthday. So 30, 35. And all around the world, Bali, Marrakesh, Morocco, Burning Man, the big festival in the desert. So I'll gather as many as 120 friends to celebrate. And I don't know if we'll be celebrating this year at Halloween. So whether we celebrate as a group or whether I just do my own internal deep dive, I'm, you know, pondering what it means to be in my 60s. It's a very interesting thing. My 50s were my best decade ever. For those who don't know it, there's something called the U-curve of happiness. While it's slightly controversial, it's generally well regarded, and I actually think it may be some Oxford professors who might have actually come up with it originally. And the premise is that basically from about age 25 till age 45, we go on a long, rather slow decline in our life satisfaction or happiness for all kinds of reasons. We could explore that if you want to talk more about that. And then 45 to 50, you sort of bottom out. In some cultures, it's actually early 50s. It's 45 to 52. But some period of time there, you hit a bottom. I don't like calling it a midlife crisis. I don't think that's exactly what it is. What it is, frankly, more than anything, is can be summed up by an equation in my book, Emotional Equations. Disappointment equals expectations minus reality. And I actually think it's when your expectations about how your life is going to be and will be, whether it's romantically, you know, long-term partnership with someone, or whether it's your career path, whether it's your health, you know, around 45, mid-40s, people sort of come face-to-face with their future, and they realize, oh, shoot, maybe my best years are behind me, and I'm never going to attain those expectations. And that can lead to what Brené Brown calls is the great midlife unraveling, not a crisis, but an unraveling. And I actually agree with her. The premise of the unraveling is you unravel all of your expectations, get back to square one and say, what's important to me? And so maybe the first half of your life is about accumulating all those expectations, and your second half of your life is about learning how to edit and discern what's truly essential and important. And I actually think that's part of the reason why people move into their 50s and they're happier than their 40s, 60s happier than 50s, 70s happier than 60s, and women in their 80s happier than the 70s. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's a U-curve. You hit bottom around 45 to 50. So you've made it through your U-curve, although this, let's be clear, your mileage may vary. We will have – this does not mean your life circumstances are only good in your 50s and beyond. In fact, quite often they're actually less good because you have health diagnoses, you have friends passing away, et cetera, parents passing away. But what is different is your response to those life circumstances.
Yeah.
So, and this is, yeah, go ahead.
No, I've been making a couple of notes. And for the last few years, you've been, you know, a key point of focus for you has been evolving the Modern Elder Academy and writing Wisdom at Work, the Making of Modern Elder. And it's been a privilege to be a small part of that journey. Speak a lot about it. So for viewers live and people listening to the podcast later, Chip talks and writes a lot about this topic. What occurs to me now, though, is to rather than necessarily address it head on, but you've been in this beautiful paradisical area of Mexico, and you are a very deep thinker who tends to make it then concise. So there's something you were talking about. You wrote a book about 8 years ago called Emotional Equations, which I really loved. And you just referred to this disappointment equals expectation minus reality.
Yes.
We also share, I think, one of our most favorite and most meaningful books, which is Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl.
Yes.
And in that, there is this idea that the greatest freedom is choice, and the choice not necessarily to change our circumstances, but how we choose to respond to external stimuli, to something that's external. So a favorite emotional equation of mine, and what I normally use to describe it for people, is almost Buddhist, which is despair equals suffering minus meaning.
Right.
And just wondering, just to address the elephant in the room about the situation we're all living through.
Yeah.
And it could be personal, it could be generic, but a lot of us, I mean, I personally have felt some really down moments over the last few months. And so in the word of suffering, however, what's the, and sometimes might struggle to go, well, what's the meaning of all of this? But also then what's the choice we can make as to how to respond to it? I just love what your own, and you and I are both pretty open processors, and we'll say what we're thinking and feeling. What are your thoughts on all of that? What have you learned through it? How have you responded, good, bad, and ugly, and also this sense that we have in places like California today and other places that this is going to go on for a long time. This isn't going to go away. And what's the meaning, and what are our choices, and how can we respond?
So Frankl came up with the three sentences that really have, I think, defined my life ever since 2008, and which is the three sentences are: between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is your power to choose your response, and in your response lies your growth and your freedom. And that's been attributed to him. That although it doesn't actually appear in Man's Search for Meaning, the book. What I will say is that when you know that you have choice in your life. And Viktor Frankl lived in a concentration camp in World War II and didn't feel like a whole lot of choice in that environment. But if you could actually create choice and create a sense of freedom in the worst of circumstances, it suggests that it is all right here. It's all here in your heart, and your ability to not, to be sort of a function of your character, not your circumstances. And so what does this mean for me today? And what do I think it means for us as a people? Well, you're right. The despair equals suffering minus meaning, that equation came from Frankl. I distilled down his book into that equation when I was going through a very difficult time in 2008 and actually literally had a flatline experience and died and came back. So what I think I came to was this recognition that yes, the Buddhists have said that the first noble truth of Buddhism is that suffering is ever present. If suffering is ever present, that means it's a constant in this equation. And the two variables are inversely proportional to each other. The more despair you have, the less meaning you have. The more meaning you have, the more despair, the less despair you have. So what that got me to realizing is, like, in the worst of times, the best thing we can do is to actually ask ourselves, what am I learning from this? What's my lesson? What wisdom am I distilling from this difficult time that will serve me in the future? And that's really what Frankl did in his concentration camp in Auschwitz, is to actually say, you also have to have a little bit of hope. You have to have a sense, like, okay, you're going to get out of the concentration camp and you're going to be able to use that. So if you get to the place where you sort of feel like, well, I'm learning a lot right now, but it won't mean anything because this is all going to fall apart. The world's going to go away. I'm going to die. Well, that doesn't help. So you have to have a certain amount of optimism that you're going to get to the other side of this. And then I think more than anything, we are meaning making machines. I wrote another book called Peak, How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow. And at the top of the employee pyramid is meaning. Money, recognition, meaning. And meaning is the intangible, it's the intrinsic motivator for people when they move beyond money and recognition in the workplace. So when you have a sense of meaning, you're actually not focusing on a job or a career, you're focusing more on a calling. So long story short is, I think that the best advice I could give anybody who's going through this time right now and finding it really baffling and bewildering and frankly quite depressing is to try to make some meaning out of it. And since the age of 26, and I'm about to turn 60, I've been, keeping a wisdom book. It's just called my wisdom book, and I have 9 of them now. And it's just, every weekend, almost every weekend, not every weekend, but almost every weekend, I'll put 3 to 6 bullet points in that book. What did I learn this week? It's not a diary. It's not a personal journal. It is literally a documentation of what I learned, because that's what gave me meaning this week, is the fact that I learned something. And usually the things I learned based upon difficult circumstances. So that's what I would recommend for people is, create your own little wisdom book.
I'm just processing that. I love it. And it links back to the thing I said in the intro about being open and being humble. It's like you're one of the core books that you anchor the curriculum of Modern Elder Academy on is Mindset by Carol Dweck.
Yeah.
And I tend to say to people that one of the things I love about Chip is that he makes wisdom very concise.
Which should be.
Exactly. In fact, my own sort of my definition of wisdom is my personal one right now is something concise that when you hear it, you feel you always knew it.
Yeah.
And the thing I remember learning from you was the difference between a growth and a fixed mindset is growth is about improve and fixed is about prove. So you said something in there about the Frankl-esque piece around choice is a function of character, not circumstance.
Yeah.
Which I loved. And then I'm just pulling some things out and this choice to go, well, in tough times in life, and you've shared publicly a number of the tough times you've had over the decades. The choice is, what am I learning? So I love that you've got a series of wisdom books that you've kept over the last 30 something years.
Yeah.
Do you have any that come to mind that you would wish to share that have popped in the last?
I mean, sometimes they're as simple as Tom. That some of them are completely mundane, and some are profane, and some are
sometimes profane.
Profound. Yeah, mundane and profane, as well as profound. It's as simple as sometimes saying, oh, God, at age 28, I think I learned this one, 2 years after I started my hotel company, is when you have something you want to present to your leadership team and that there are going to be some naysayers, have one-on-ones with the naysayers before you go into the meeting a few days in advance, just so that they're not surprised and they don't go straight to the naysayer place. Well, that's something that's really obvious to me at 59, almost 60 years old today. But at age 28, it wasn't obvious to me. Mm. So that's a mundane example. A maybe more profound example would be, I think a more profound example would be that my happiness is often very self-focused. My joy feels much more like happiness is almost circumstantial, and joy comes from within. And happiness tends to be something that is self-focused, the pursuit of your own happiness, let's be honest. Whereas joy actually seeks out company. Not to say that happiness doesn't as well. I mean, you have a party and you have a happy party and everybody's drinking and having fun. That's fine. But there's an element of joy that, to me, that speaks to something bigger than yourself. So I think when I, you know, funny, for a person who started a company and called it Joie de Vivre, mm-hmm. I've always been fascinated by happiness and joy. And J.D. Salinger, who wrote The Catcher in the Rye, said happiness is a solid and joy is a liquid. what he really meant by that is, you know, happiness is usually tangible. Joy is somewhat intangible. And yet the things that we most appreciate in life are often the intangibles, the things that are hard to put into words, that are sort of awe-inspiring in a particular moment where you just say, looking at the view behind you, Tom, and you look at that and you're there. And if it's giving you a sense of joy, you sort of want to share that. So I don't know. I would just say, for me, understanding the difference between happiness and joy has been a fascinating journey for me, because actually I think in some ways, being a travel industry person, I think we all need travel psychologists. Alain de Botton from London, you know, from the UK, from England, taught me this in one of his books, is the idea that, man, when you're going to take a vacation, what is it that you're emotionally trying to solve for? I never thought of that. Like, is it curiosity? Is it narcissism? What is the thing that you're actually looking for? And I have gotten more and more clear that when I'm taking a vacation, I'm looking more for joy than happiness. So that's something that is literally something that came out of one of my wisdom books a long time ago.
Yeah, very cool. I one of the things I used to teach people quite often was around different ways of processing information, around thinking, feeling, and knowing, and that we all have a different primary, a different secondary sense, and then the other that we rarely use. Mm-hmm. So CEOs tend to be typically highly instinctive. They know really quickly what to do. And one of the things I remind board members is you can know wrong.
A lot of evidence of that, for sure.
As long as you know right more often than you know wrong, you tend to rise through the ranks, and there's a lot of high-knowing people in top leadership positions.
Well, let's unpack that. I think knowing is, in some ways, and you talked about instinctive, it's about intuition.
Yeah.
And in many ways, I haven't written this guest post yet. I have a blog post, as you know, called Wisdom Well, that comes out daily. And I'm fascinated by the difference between intuition and wisdom. Mm-hmm. Or are they the same? Because actually, in both cases, I think pattern recognition is fundamental to what gives you that sense of wisdom or intuition. To me, intuition may be a more somatic, almost like it's in your gut instinct, intuition. Whereas wisdom feels, maybe it's a little more brain focused, but it's a little bit, it's actually almost tapping into something beyond yourself. But I think this idea that as we've been on the planet longer and we've had more opportunity to observe patterns and recognize patterns in an economy, in human beings, in our own behaviors, we get better if we are good at cultivating, harvesting wisdom or intuition at being able to see those earlier. So we can sort of see the future. We know how this movie's going to end. And that to me is, that is what knowing is about. Knowing is like, I know it. I can feel it down to my toes.
Yeah.
And then you can evaluate whether you were right or not. And generally speaking, when it feels really intuitive or from coming from a place of wisdom, mm-hmm. as opposed to a place from ego or a place from purely just, you know, mm-hmm. there's a lot, knowing can have a lot of different.
Yeah. I mean, let me ramble on that as well a bit and join in. The piece I was looking to go to was, fundamentally that we will make choices ultimately in a knowing space, but what takes us there? So I'll come back to the wisdom piece in a minute, but advice to families, if you're trying to choose a vacation, it's the bit around the Alain de Botton, who runs an operation called the School of Life in London, for those who are tuning in. And it's about if you can make it in a feeling space, it's really great. So how do you want to feel? It's not the rationality of the thinking. It's not I just want to go to Croatia. All right. Well, what do you want to experience there? Happiness or joy? My own little very concise distillation is that knowing is a combination of intuition and experience. And the example I would give is I have three sons who are now grown. And the middle one, at about age 7, we had to teach him how to do math the way the school wanted him to. Mm-hmm. Now, all three of my kids are off the charts good at math, all right? But my middle one was extraordinary. His brain worked so fast, he never had to do the workings. Mm. He would look at it and go, when he started to do math that was beyond doing the times tables, he just knew the answer and he wrote it down. Mm-hmm. Mm. Now, on the odd occasion he would get it wrong, he would get 0 marks. But if he'd done the workings, he'd still get 80% of the marks. Mm. So we had to teach him to slow his brain down and do it. So the point being that he was highly intuitive at a really young age, mm-hmm. and he's always very high knowing, my middle son. Mm-hmm. So there is that combination of around that for me. And then there's the piece that maintains a bit of humility as we get older and we do pattern recognition and we learn more, which is one of my phrases, which is not all wise people are old and not all old people are wise.
Of course.
This goes back to the mentoring piece and your modern elder piece about being a mentor and both a mm-hmm. mentor and an intern. And I have a friend. I have a 25-year-old who went to college with one of my sons, right, who I was mentoring. Mm-hmm. One of the wisest people I ever met. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's kind of cool. I think a thought for me just to use some of the remaining time we have is some really quite profound stuff, which is often a direction you and I go to when we talk. And if we tap into your rebel entrepreneur self, right, if you were in a place in life where you were choosing to be really entrepreneurial, you were 26, 28 years old and launching a hotel company, you did that. But if you were still in that place, you were looking to do that, and you were back in San Francisco, where you spent much of your life, mm-hmm. What business would you launch now where you see, as an entrepreneur, we see gaps. Mm-hmm. What's the one you would launch now as we emerge at some point out of COVID?
Well, it's an interesting question. First of all, let me say, I'm going to speak for myself on this, but I think as someone hears me, do know I'm not suggesting you do this. I think you know, Richard Branson wrote the foreword to my first book called The Rebel Rules. And he said, when I'm starting a new business, I always ask myself, I always have the mantra, I am the market, I am the market, I am the market. And that mantra is based upon the premise that you better be passionate about the thing you're creating. Yeah. And you are the customer. You're the person that you're trying to satisfy. And if you have a really inspired perspective on this, you're going to have a high standard, which is actually why MEA works for me, because Modern Elder Academy, because I am the customer and I have a high standard for what I want us to do here. I would say that the thing that would be most interesting to me, Tom, and I've spent a lot of time talking to Brian Chesky, the co-founder and CEO of Airbnb about this, and they have adopted some of this, but not the full-fledged piece of it, is I think what's interesting for the future is matchmaking. And I don't mean dating matchmaking. I mean, how do you use artificial intelligence and buy in from customers such, you know, you can't, I don't think, you know, I think the EU is on, has been a step ahead of the United States on this in terms of like, people have to buy into saying, I'm willing to do this.
GDPR, you know, yes. Yeah.
I'm willing to have you, you know, whomever the company is to be able to match make. And frankly, I think that you can ask, you could ask, have a test, a beautiful 10 question test that would allow us to understand the matchmaking. But matchmaking, so we understand you and we can help deliver to you the collection of people in the world who are most interesting to you and most, most generative to you. So what would the business be? Well, the business could be an adjunct of Airbnb, such that, for example, in a time where we're all hunkered down at home, wouldn't it be interesting if Airbnb created small tribes of 6 to 10 people that are pen pals, travel pen pals from around the world who have the closest match to you in terms of what your interests are, what kind of tastes you have in places you go, what kind of things you like doing, such that that collection of people not only become a new collection of friends from all over the world, but they're your lifestyle curators to help you determine what you want to go out and experience and do in the world. And that could, you know, today be in your own backyard. But I think, you know, if we want to use artificial intelligence to a good, it would be helping matchmaking of mutual mentorships. Wouldn't it be interesting, Tom, if you knew there was a subject you really wanted to learn and you knew you had some topics that you were really good at, how could artificial intelligence match you with someone else in the world who may be a different generation than you so that the two of you could actually be mutual mentors, mentors and interns at the same time?
It's funny. When you talk about being the customer, I love the way you've taken, to me, kind of a confluence of the need for trust online, which Airbnb has.
Yep.
Business moves at the speed of trust. I can't remember the name of the book, the author.
Stephen Covey Jr. Yep, Stephen Covey Jr.
And you look at AI for good. Dr. Vivian Ming does incredible work on that, for example. You look at all of that, you pull it together, you see the opportunity. People, we're not just meaning makers, but we're connection creators, right? We're looking for connection, and we're getting more isolated in the online world. And the COVID reality is probably making us all look to choose to learn around that. And I immediately went to mentoring when you talked about that, about how do you match people? Because I probably spend half my time mentoring. I love it. I get so much joy and I learn all the time. And I'm involved with so many networks and they're either fully automated in terms of matching or they're fully manual. And the idea of using AI in the middle, I totally love that. So I've got my big takeaway from this conversation. I guess I'm looking to sort of time it and wrap up in a couple of minutes. Give us but I do need to know, what's your white paper about? At least what?
I've been intrigued by the fact that lifelong learning is a DIY enterprise. It's do it yourself. Mm-hmm. And we expect people somehow, you know, there's a couple of UK professors from London, Andrew Scott and Linda Grattan, who wrote The 100-Year Life, and they have a newer book they've brought out. And their whole premise in the book is that we're no longer going to have linear paths that, like, you know, that we've had in the past. And so life is fully about transitions. And yet we have so little support for people in their lifelong learning to understand what they're supposed to learn and including what they've mastered that they could actually apply elsewhere. So the title of the white paper is the emergence of not lifelong learning, but the emergence of long life learning. And the subtitle is how midlife evolved from a crisis to a calling. And the basic premise here is that we have an extreme need in society to help people in midlife, predominantly aged, let's say 40 to 70, to have the opportunity to do a midlife pit stop or multiple pit stops to actually reimagine and repurpose themselves. We haven't set ourselves up as a society very well to accommodate this. And this is part of the reason why a growing number of people are feeling lost and bewildered in midlife. And so long story short is I think that shifting lifelong learning to long life learning helps people to understand how do I live a life that is as deep and meaningful and happy as it is long, because the longevity piece we've gotten better at over the past 100 years. We have not necessarily gotten better at the depth or happiness or joy that we take from our lives. So, it's going to be unleashed on the world in the next month or two, but we're doing some peer reviews of it right now.
Well, I'll look to amplify it once you publish
yes,
it.
Yes, thank you.
So I think I'm going to wrap with pulling together the idea of the choice at a time like this that you looked at was what am I learning? And the piece you finished off by describing in white paper was, you know, how can we make life deep and meaningful and happy and long life learning and have a, not just an act, you know, not just live long, but have an active and deep and meaningful and happy and joyful life. I think there's a massive paradigm shift there, which is around the last 50 years, Western society has all been about how much can we acquire? How much monetary wealth can we get? But really, what's the point if it's not deep and meaningful and happy and joyful? What about investing from, as you say, around age 40 to 70 so that your U curve keeps accelerating upwards, 70s, right. 80s, 90s? No bullet point list of takeaways, but a lot of wisdom. So, let me just, try to work out the tech on this. This is only the third one. So I can never tell quite when it's going to end, but for now I'll say, many, many thanks for coming on. It's always a pleasure and a privilege.
Thank you, Tom. It's great. It's great to see you and your Scottish background.
Thank you. And I wish it wasn't virtual, but at some point I'll get there. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Cheers. Great to see you.